You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
Hey everyone, the podcast you're about to listen to is a recording from a guest speaker at our last Fishery Science Symposium that we hosted in New Orleans, Louisiana last month. We hosted our third Fishery Science Symposium with the goal of further unifying the angling community, fostering productive discussion, and inspiring stewardship across sectors. Our science symposiums foster a collaborative learning environment for industry leaders that includes guides, anglers, brand representatives, small business owners, media scientists, state representatives, you name it. If you're a stakeholder in the fishing and outdoor industry, you have a place in these conversations. Our fall 2024 event was the first of its kind for the Louisiana angling community, and it was largely a great success. So we appreciate everyone who came out, but these events are intended to be a multimedia event. So you can access a full library of presentation coverage on the ASGA YouTube. You can see those videos. You can also obviously listen to them all as individual podcast episodes. We had a great lineup of speakers. Dr. Marcus Dryman, a fisheries ecologist at the Mississippi State University, stopped by to talk about Jack Crevalle and a proactive approach for an underappreciated fishery. We also had Chris Shibley and Jason Adrians from LDWF check in to talk about the latest on redfish in Louisiana and the LA Creel program. Ben Meadows, who is an economist and professor at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, stopped by give a pretty engaging presentation about the untold economic impacts of redfish in Louisiana. And then Lu Yen Cho from the Got One app, as many of you know, stopped by to talk about how apps and artificial intelligence are changing the game for fisheries. So be sure to check out each speaker from the lineup. And without further ado, enjoy a digital check-in to the third ASGA Fishery Science Symposium.
And thank you, Jason, very much for coming today. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah, for those of you who don't know me, I've seen in commission meetings, but I'm Jason Adrians. I'm the FinFish Program Manager at Wildlife and Fisheries. I've got a short 53-slide presentation, two and a half hours tops. No, it's very high level. I've cut it down to about 12 slides, 15 slides. Please ask questions, because this is skims the top of what we've done with redfish over the last 2 years. To start out, just some basic biology, and if y'all already know this, listen again. A lot of you know they're a long-lived species. Here we've aged up. We use 39 years in our stock assessment. Some states they may have aged, some that are a little older in the 40s. We use 39. 100% maturity in males is by about age 5, females about age 6. Growth, really, you remember Marcus's graph with Jack growth. Redfish, after about age 5, that growth really asymptotes. We have a hard time determining by length, really, how old is that fish. That 30-inch redfish could be 5 years old, could be 30 years old. They spawn near shore, tidal passes. Starts about mid-August, so just not that long ago. Goes through about mid-November. The peak's really earlier than November. So this year's been kind of good. We've had one hurricane, but at least we haven't had a lot like the past few years when you have those young juveniles, those young of the year, those larvae, trying to make it into the estuary. Hurricanes can really wreak havoc on that. Average redfish, about 2 million eggs per spawn. Spawns can spawn every 7 days. Doesn't mean they do. Some may not even spawn in a particular year, and they'll wait till next year. Those eggs hatch in about 2 days, roughly. They'll spend about 2 to 3 weeks in the offshore water column. Then they'll move into the estuaries. Little information about here, you know, about 8 inches their first spring. So this presentation is based on our old regulation. So you had about 1.5 years till they got to that bottom of the slot that we used to fish here, 16 inches. Inshore population is mainly sub-adults, and we'll talk about that a little later. where some of our management came from and why we proposed the regulations we did. It has to do with those sub-adults and when they move offshore. And then they're a little more tolerant than some of our other fish. They can tolerate a wide range of salinities. Next slide. This is just a graphic of what I was talking about maturity. This is female maturity by age based on our data here in Louisiana. So you can see by age 6, all those females are mature. Most of them by age 5 cross that 50% threshold somewhere around age 4. Next. So management history. We can go on to the next one. Wow, I got to get over here and read this. So really the first limit started in about 1984. So you can see we just recently changed in 2024. So we had a long period of essentially the same regulations that came about in mid to late 80s. So in 1984, the creel limit was 50 fish, but that was a combined creel limit of trout and red drum. So the old days where they talked about a good day was a box of fish. This is your box of fish, 50 red fish or trout or a mixture thereof. At that time, there was a recreational size limit that had a 36-inch maximum essentially, but allowed two fish over that. So then we started getting into, you know, at this time, the federal government was really looking into redfish. You had Paul Prudhomme and the redfish craze. So management really, it was fast and furious in the late 80s. So in 86, you had for the first time a commercial size limit come in with a maximum of 30 inches. You had the recreational size limit, the maximum dropped down to 30, still two fish over. 87. We saw the first slot come into play in the recreational fishery. It was 14 to 30 inches, still the two fish over 30. Commercial size limit, there was a slot at that point put in place, 18 to 30. Also a quota at that time was, the quota was next year. No, it was that year, sorry, 1.8 million pounds. So 88 is when everything really, 88 had a couple months where management was several months in a row. That's when we had the old 16 to 27 come into place, the five fish creel. Commercial harvest at that time underwent a temporary harvest moratorium that eventually became permanent. And then red drum was given game fish status. By 91, that commercial moratorium was made permanent and it became pretty much a recreational species. 2008 was a gear change by the legislature. That was the year they allowed bow and arrow gear to be used for redfish. And then just recently, this year in June, we have our new slot of 18 to 27 inches with no fish over 27 inches. And then the creel dropped to 4, and then no guide limits allowed. So like in the past where you could go out, you could fish, if it was 4 of y'all and a guide, you could keep a guide's limit. That's no longer allowed. Next. So I'll move back over here since you got the camera. So we started embarking on red drum management a couple years ago. And with that, we presented our assessment to our commission. And this is just a summary of what was in that assessment. The stock we found is not overfished, but we had overfishing occurring. So we were removing too many, and that'll come into play when I show you our escapement rate graphic. That overfishing had occurred frequently in the last decade. So 8 out of the last 10 years that had been occurring where that fishing mortality was above our threshold. The SBR had been declining since 2005, so that's the spawning population. Sorry, I didn't define it there. To spawning potential ratio, it's a metric we use to measure the spawning stock of redfish. That had been declining since 2005. Recent recreational landings are the lowest we had seen since the 80s. Recruitment has also been an issue recently. And those of you that are out there every day, you see our coastal land loss. that probably plays into this, along with the changes we're experiencing, whether it's water temperatures, warmer or colder winters, those sorts of things. Recruitment's so environmentally driven. We have a hard time really figuring out what drives recruitment very well. But we had seen recruitment declining since the mid-90s. And then this is just a little, our assessment, we don't just do it in-house, throw it out there and say, okay, this is our science, you gotta believe it. We actually send it out to all the Gulf states. We send it to NOAA assessment scientists. We have external scientists review our stock assessment because we want to get those comments back to show you that we're not just doing this in a vacuum. So we let our assessment go out to peer review. Next. So you can see this graphic over here is the spawning stock. And you can see it's this yellow line is our target. Red line is the limit. And in this graphic, you don't want to be below the red line. You can see that spawning population has been declining. It is still well above target. However, that's where escapement comes into play. You remember those subadults, the fish you fish on inshore, those are all subadults. And the management metric we use is escapement. So we want 30% of those subadults to get out of the estuaries, get offshore, and enter the spawning population. That's the limit, essentially. That goes back to some agreements between all the Gulf states in cooperation with Gulf Council. But you can see we dropped below target, you know, back here around 2010, and we've been bouncing below the limit for a few years, and now we've been below the limit for a while. We're down at closer to 20% escapement. So when we propose management, the idea is, okay, we need to build escapement back up above that limit. And by doing that, hopefully over time, we'll stabilize the spawning population. Now, because they're long-lived, and escapement is looking at those first five age classes, you'll see escapement rebuild first. Your spawning population may still continue to decline, but then it's going to end up stabilizing out at target eventually as you deal with escapement. So in our projections going forward, and we project this out for the life of Red Drum, in our projections, you may see this go down. You may see, I've seen some of our graphics where we get down below target. We never get below limit, but we get below target before the stock gets back up to around target. And that's because this is measuring those first 5 years. And as you rebuild those age classes out to 40 years, you rebuild that spawning population. So our new regulations looked at how do we still provide the most opportunity for our anglers while doing the right thing for the stock. And we eventually came up with those regulations we did to do that because the main objective here is to get escapement back to target. When we do that, the rest of it will take care of itself. I know it's a little, you know, thinking out that far is a little hard for some folks thinking. We project out 40 years for this stock, but you got to remember that spawning population is not expected to get below the limit. It will get below target, not for long, but it'll rebuild the target. Escapement is the big one we're trying to manage and get back up to where it needs to be. Next. Is it stuck? Uh-oh. Okay. So you remember I talked about recruitment. Here you can see what recruitment's been doing. Average recruitment is over there. You can see about 3.8 million annually. You can see recruitment's down there in the 1.4 million neighborhood. Oh, I forgot to mention, on all these graphics, you'll see a little you'll see a yellow circle. That's the average of the last three assessment or the last 3 years in the assessment. We don't use the last point in the assessment. Generally, that last point in an assessment is your most uncertain. So we use an average of the last 3 years. Just to give you an idea of landings, you can see kind of what's happened with the stock over time in terms of landings. You can see when the commercial fishery was really at its peak, you can see those landings. And they're divided up by inshore, offshore for the commercial landings. You can see they peaked there close to 16 million pounds a year Gulf-wide. And then, of course, the recreational, after the commercial fishery was banned, it was strictly a recreational fishery. And you can see what happened with recreational landings is that commercial fishery was almost substituted, at least in Louisiana. Recreational landings far outpaced commercial landings at some point in the 90s. So there was still a lot of pressure on that stock, even when it became strictly a recreational stock. And you can see what landings have done recently. You can see where we've come back down and landings are lower than they have been. So Chris is going to talk about LaCreel next, but one of the things it allows us to do is we now don't just have statewide landings information. All the blue bars are the previous MRIP survey. We've hindcast and adjusted these landings to our LaCreel landings by the ratio we have of LaCreel to MRIP, but we weren't able to go to a basin level prior to LA Creel. LA Creel allows us to get to a basin level, and here you can see in those bar graphs since 2014, we've broken out the landings by each basin.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Really basic question. Landings only counts harvested kept fish, right? So discards are not mean landings, or are they?
In this graphic, it does not include discards. Correct. If any of you have all have seen my presentations to the commission, we will actually have landings. We'll have total harvest, landings and discards. And that's it. Tried to keep it quick and so we can do more questions. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all for allowing us to come talk with you today. I think this is a good opportunity for people to, you know, just be able to have an interactive conversation with us. So as I go through all this, it's not just me talking to you. So if you think of something while I'm going through a slide, just stop and ask me. And we'll continue on afterwards as well while y'all are eating lunch and keep the conversation going about stuff. So that's what this really is. If y'all don't know me, my name's Chris Shibley. I'm the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the department. And Jason is our Chief Fishery Scientist. So if it's fish questions with regard to marine fisheries, we're the guys to ask today. So it doesn't have to be specific to redfish or LA Creel. We thought these were relevant topics today, but if you have something you want to ask about trout, sheephead, or even Jack Revelle's, as we saw earlier. That's fine. Trout's done? Yeah. He's traumatized with a little PTSD, so maybe we won't talk about trout. But anyway, so some of you were able to participate in our LA Creel 10-year anniversary town hall meeting we had back in May at headquarters. And I want to thank you all who showed up and also online for that, because it's sort of important with regards to documenting and keeping track of fisheries in our state. And as you'll see in a little bit, it expands to the entire Gulf of Mexico, not just Louisiana. It's relative for all of that. But this is kind of like a recap of what we did back in May. So it's a shorter version, but it hits on the main topics. And for those of you who weren't able to actually participate in that back then. So this is a brief timeline. As I said, it's our 10-year anniversary for LA Creel. So back before 2014, we started out with a yellowfin tuna permit, where we were issuing permits for trying to keep track of tuna that were harvested in the Gulf. And that kind of turned into basically a snapper survey. And we were looking at just red snapper for potentially state management. And then in 2014, we realized as a department, we were not getting the information that we needed to keep track of our species that we manage from MRIP. So if you all know MRIP, it's the Marine Recreational Information Program, right? That's what it is. It did not give us very good information at all about our state managed species. So for example, there were some years where our stock looked terrible and other years it looked great, but it was very inconsistent. But we found that a better survey with better saturation and a better sample size and design really worked well for our state species as we were doing the snapper survey stuff. So in 2014, we said, well, we're going with LA creel because we need this. In 2015, we benchmarked LA creel against MRIP. So that meant we did side-by-side surveys. So if any of y'all remember that, it was probably a giant pain for you guys coming back to the dock and getting hit with two different surveys. But what that did is it allowed us to be able to show LA creel provide the best or better data than what MRIP did at the same time. So the feds, NOAA, certified us in 2018 as a replacement for MRIP. So now we're running wide open with LA creel, and we do not have to have MRIP in the state of Louisiana. Other states still use it. And then we had nine species up until 2021. We added triggerfish to the roster of species that our RLP actually surveys. So if you do offshore fishing, you have to have a recreational offshore landing permit. It's required, but it's free. But it allows us to identify those groups of anglers that go offshore saltwater fishing. And that's the biggest problem with MRIP in the Gulf, is that it used the saltwater license frame to define effort in the Gulf of Mexico. So if you're trying to find out how many people are going fishing, you don't call the entire saltwater angler system and ask them if they went fishing and apply that to offshore species only, because Jason might have a saltwater license, but he might only go trout fishing because he hates trout. No, just kidding. But the guys that go offshore fishing, we need to define them separately from the guys that go inshore fishing. So that's what the RLP actually helps us do, and it got implemented at that same time. So next slide, please. So this is the definition of what it really does, but in a nutshell, it helps us to monitor our inshore species that we're required legislatively to manage. So that's mullet, black drum, flounder, sheep's head, and then we also obviously manage with stock assessments, red drum and spotted sea trout, but those are not legislatively mandated. But we do it ourselves. Next slide. So the journal methodology, and we're gonna have a kind of flow chart for this in one of the next slides here to break it down, but essentially when you come to the dock and one of my biologists comes up there and asks you, did you go saltwater fishing today? That's the first question they ask. And you say yes, then they proceed to a series of questions after that. And they're gonna ask you, you know, how many fish did you keep? How many did you let go? What did you target? What was your species of harvest? And then later, subsequent to that, the next week, we do an email and phone survey. It's combined, and it's done by a group that's called our South Central Planning Commission. So the department is not actually calling you, even though when the phone says it's the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, it's actually coming from an outside group that we contract to make it neutral. They call, they get the effort information from you, so they're gonna ask you on the phone, did you go fishing this past week? How many trips did you do? But they're not gonna ask you, how many fish did you catch? And that's a question we commonly get when people ask us about LA creels. Why don't you ask me how many fish I caught when you call me on the phone or you give me the email survey? It's important to realize that we're after the effort when you're getting the call, but we're getting your fish that you caught when we do the dockside landing. So you come to the dock and you get surveyed, but other people will say, well, I've never been surveyed at the dock. So we get enough people at the dock that are surveyed that we can extrapolate that out to get an average harvest estimate. So we get a landing rate at the dock, we get the effort survey, we put those together, and that equals the harvest estimate at the bottom. So I think the next slide there has kind of the flow chart here. So this shows you the breakdown of exactly how we go through each of our site frames, as they call that. So we have inshore and offshore privates anglers, which are some of you guys, but also the charter inshore and offshore, which are the remainder of you guys. And we split that by weekday assignments and weekend assignments to differentiate the effort, because obviously weekend is a little bit higher effort than you get during the week. And then we go through the assignment draws, we call it, and it's picked by basin. So those are the basins listed there where those come from. And then we get a random selection from those basins based on the site frame to give us the distribution for each of our coastal study areas, which are CSAs, right? Those are based on basins. So a coastal study area here is CSA 1. The other side of the river is going to be CSA 3, et cetera, and we go through. And they're based on these basins. And this is the propensity of assignments that they get per week. So, you know, obviously, you want to have Lower Barataria have a little bit higher on a weekend draw because you have marinas like Venice, Cypress Cove down there, right? Even Delta Marina is a pretty big one for some offshore pressures. Some of these other ones, you'll see that they don't get the same amount because they're not going to have that offshore component to it. So we have to kind of separate it out, but that's how the draw is done. And these are the total sites that we have in LA Creel. So I know there's a lot of numbers you can barely read on this thing, but it shows you by basin where all the different marinas are that we actually target for our harvest estimate to come in for the dockside landings. And you can see, you know, there's some gaps as we go across the coast to the west because there just really aren't marinas in some areas and people don't fish in those areas that we can meet them at the dock to intercept them. So if we can't intercept them, we can't interview them. So we just don't have places in those areas. But, you know, obviously epicenter is right around this area here, right, where we get the bulk of it through Terrebonne and then a little bit less towards the west. But thank you. So this is last year's data, not this year so far because we're not complete, but we had 1,608 assignments that are worked. And keep in mind, some of those are affected by weather sometimes. Sometimes hurricanes come, we miss assignments because the marinas are closed, so we don't get to do them. But we interviewed 10,675 parties, so that's like vessels mostly. But that equals about 28,000 anglers. And then the key to this whole thing that I like especially is that 86, almost 87,000 fish are counted by a biologist. Now, reported and counted are two different things. Some states, they ask you, what'd you catch? You tell them, that's how they get their harvest estimate. They don't actually touch the fish, right? We're touching fish. So when you come back to the dock, and my staff are there, they say, can I see your fish? And you say, sure. And you open up the cooler if you landed fish and brought them back, and we pull them out, and we actually count those fish. We don't just assume what you caught based on what you said. So that's a big difference. Observed and reported are critical things in a survey to get things right. And it shows you the catch effort by basin. So obviously, a lot of you all fish in the Pontchartrain Basin, which includes, you know, the Biloxi Marsh and then Delacroix as well. But Barataria by far usually leads the group, but it's also because of those larger marinas that are down near Venice, right? Cypress Cove, Venice, they pull in a lot of activity. So you're going to have a large catch effort with that. And then offshore, you know, it's surprising the amount of catch effort that we have offshore because of just access to offshore. It's just really limited on certain marinas that you can actually go out of, but we do have a pretty good catch effort. So next slide. So this flow chart breaks down how we do the effort component of the survey. So we talked about dockside first, our staff coming to talk to you. The second component is the effort survey, which is done by the call service. So we have a random draw of 1,600 anglers that are done. This is the proportion of it. It shows you 400 ROP. And then the regions, the next slide after this is a map. So don't worry about where these regions are. I'll show you in a second. And then out of state is in there. But also note down here that the ROP frame during snapper season increases to 100% of the draw. So whoever's got a ROP, you become part of the draw and you could get called at that point. So then the charter guys, for y'all over here, you have a separate ROP if you actually go offshore fishing. If you don't, obviously you'll still get drawn with that randomly selected. That works its way down to how many anglers by area fished. And then we have those same regions. So switch to the map real quick so I can show. All right, so we call out of state, which could be anywhere in the United States, is one of the regions. ROP is anything offshore with that permit. And then these are the regions that we break it down to. So some people ask us, well, you're only looking at fishing effort from down here because that's where everybody fishes, right? You're not talking to people up here. Well, we are because they have a saltwater license. They might live up in Monroe, but they go saltwater fishing sometimes. So they're going to end up in that draw for a random call just like you are if you live down here. And they may or may not have gone fishing. If we call and they say no, well, then they didn't, and it doesn't go into the effort. So that's how this works. It works pretty well. A lot of other systems don't go to this level of refinement, and I think that's important to understand. So next slide. So this is the effort breakdown by those different regions that we just showed. 97,600 attempted survey contacts. So that includes the email that goes out first. If you get the email first and you respond to it, you won't get called. So that's the key. If you're sick of us calling you, respond to the email first within the first 2 days and we'll never call you that week. The completion rate is 50%, but that's not the compliance rate. So that's a big difference. I want you to understand that the completion rate of those is 50% of those attempted survey contacts, which is still larger than anything MRIP has ever had. So 6,400 of those come from email and about 42,000 come from phone surveys. And then if you look at how it's broken down by region, like I said, Southeast, obviously the orange bars, that's that large region over here where most of it's going to come from. But you're also going to see some of this coming from the north, the blue bars that are way down here. And that's important. It's fairly stable, but it's also included in each of the years fairly equally. So I think that's important to note. And the compliance rate is... We're at about 90%, is that right? For our overall compliance rate when you combine everything? Yeah. And some other states that have surveys where they use app-based surveys, their compliance rate is below 50%, just so we realize that. But so you take the two parts that I just talked about and you combine them, so that's what this means. So you've got the doc side over here, and then you've got the effort component here. We take those, put them together each week, and we come up with a harvest estimate for that particular week. And this what's allows us to keep track of Red Snapper on a weekly basis. So a lot of times, if you see our news releases come out or our social media posts, we're talking about the landings for Red Snapper each week as we go through the season. It's because we have an allocation that we have to monitor to. So there's a catch limit of 934,527, whatever it is, pounds of Red Snapper that the state of Louisiana gets. We don't do weekly estimates for red drum or spotted sea trout or flounder for that matter, because there's no catch limit or target that we have to achieve by the end of the year for those species. So that's the difference as to why people see a red snapper landing estimate every week and you don't see a red drum landing estimate every week. It's not necessary.
Something I noticed on there too is we also adjust for an out of frame proportion of anglers. So that's whether they're kids that don't need a license yet, or somebody that just, oh, I need to buy a license. We ask docs, we find out dockside if someone had a license or not, or we see that they're obviously folks that are under 18 don't need a license yet. We get those data as well. It said there's an out of frame adjustment. So we adjust for those anglers that are not just in our license frame, but those that are fishing that for one reason or another don't have a license. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Chris, I'll make a comment just how we stand is. So with Maryland, we made a tragic mistake. Thought it was a good idea. This was pre-NRIP. We worked under a different system called MRFs, which was, I don't even get into, was not a great system. But during the MRFs years, there was a push for a boat license in Maryland. So instead of buying my individual angling license and just being a private recreational angler for like $50 or $100, I can get a boat sticker. And that licensed everyone on my vessel, up to six people, including me. So if I had family come in from out of town or whatever, nobody ever had to buy a license as long as they were on my boat. So the unfortunate side effect of that is we have no clue how many people are fishing in the state of Maryland in the Chesapeake Bay, because you just have blanket coverage. We know how many boat licenses we sold, and that's about as good as a screen door on a submarine, because we don't know how, you know, were they averaging two people, three people? Do they have family in every weekend? Do they have, you know, five kids who are above 18 and they don't have to buy licenses? It is, and it's almost like you open up Pandora's box and you can never take it back.
Yeah.
Because if, you know, if you took a boat license away, it would be a meltdown. And then to take it a step further, In saltwater, there are several states on the East Coast that don't require a fishing license. So you're supposed to sign up for this federal angler registry. Yeah. And not many people do that. And they just have grown up with never having a license. So these are big states like New York and New Jersey that don't have saltwater fishing licenses. And there are a lot of people in those two states. So you put bad data in, you get bad data out, and y'all are not experiencing that in Louisiana. And I'm telling you, like, these guys that are crunching these numbers and doing these surveys, give them the proper information. Take the time to do this if you get the phone call, because it matters a lot. Because we are, like, just SOL, just out of luck. On the East Coast, we're in a terrible situation. So I just want to say that for you.
No, it's a great point. At the federal level, they were pushing very much so for vessel level reporting, which is what you're talking about, yeah. Right? And vessel level reporting at the dock side is fine because you have one person that reports for the entire vessel, but how can you do the effort survey on the back side of that? Who are we targeting? You know, what's the audience that we're gonna get the response from? So I may end up sending you an email, but you aren't the one that was on the dock side reporting the landings, right? So if you go into the vessel level, it really doesn't do any good. You need to have individual angler level reporting. And that's what this system does. It's about to blow up, is that what
I don't know if that's the project.
That's this thing?
Yeah, it's not the left.
So I got 234 seconds left, so let's time me here. So this is the key slide of this whole thing, so hopefully it'll stay up here long enough before it shuts off. But the point of why I wanted to talk about LA Creel is because we're seeing kind of an increased dockside refusal rate. And a lot of that is by charter captains lately. And I don't think it's the charter captains in this room. I think it's other charter captains that are feeling more of the effect of the no charter or guide limit retention with some of these regulations for spotted sea trout and also with red drum. I think we're getting kickback on that from folks out there that are fishing, particularly charter captains that normally retain fish. So what they don't understand is they think that if they don't report the fish by participating in the survey, that there's going to be more fish that aren't counted, so therefore there's more left for them to catch next time. If I report them and they count as harvested, it counts against me. That's not how this works. All that does is increase the error of the survey, and the relative standard error by the end of the year, because their annual landing estimates will be huge versus where it is now, where we're at about 6%.
Yeah, so I believe our survey in Florida, where you see that they're like survey at land, one of the things is it's separate from regulate enforcement. So like you come in, they're like, hey, can we measure all your mangrove snappers?
Yep.
They can get an idea of one of the things is like if you were short by half an inch,
yep.
The really good survey can't call and say, like, nope. Come get them. Is there a similar thing to your words?
Exactly the same. Yep. I can't tell you how many times my staff come back and they have on the data sheet reported a guy thought he was catching perch, and he's got a whole bunch of mangrove snapper this big in his bucket, right? Because he thought they were perch. I'm like, perch with teeth? I mean, come on. You know? So we don't go call enforcement and say, this guy's got a whole bunch of gray snapper that are way undersized over here. Go visit them. You know, we don't do any of that. Yeah, it's an understood thing. So we're trying to get objective, unbiased science, and enforcement could come at their own regard and come to the dock and inspect things at that point, but we're not giving them the clue. So
ultimately, if I don't tell you how many we're catching, you know, maybe it won't take as many. If you're not reporting all those fish, or our catch rates are lower than we think, that's going to show reduced landings. And without any other explanation, we may see that as an issue with the stock. Right. The effort is still the same, but our landings have plummeted. Something must be going on with the stock. So you may be putting yourself at a point where more restrictive management is put in place because you didn't report it, short of any other information.
So the take-home message from this slide and this whole presentation is we need your help. We need you guys out there on the dock. When my staff come up and approach you with their LA Creel t-shirts on and they say, hey, can I interview you? And you say, yes, hopefully, please, even though the gnats are in your ear and you don't want to go home, it's a long, hot day. just briefly do it. It takes like less than 4 minutes to go through the entire LA Creel survey and let them look at your fish. Because what I want is I want other anglers and other charter captains to see you interacting with our staff and volunteering that information, because it's important. And when that effort survey is sent out to you, participate in that as well. And try to pass the word around the dock to other charter captains. They're like, oh, I'm not participating in that. That's stupid, you know, or whatever. Or they're just going to take more of our fish away. Try to briefly explain to them. Just call us or email us, and we'll explain it to them if they need it. But participation in it is important to get real data. So, yeah.
My great thing is about it from my communication to outreach side, and also the digital space. But like, there's a new trend now where it's like, if someone were to come up, enforcement, check the jet, light check, and spit on YouTube, social media, like, make things like, you know, officer comes and stops and he goes through my fish. But it's like, that's a normal thing, and that you did nothing wrong with that.
Right.
So the flip side of it is, we all have the opportunity. Guys are very well respected.
Yep.
We have the work community, and now the followers see what's going on, to show, like, hey, they just checked it, and all good. Appreciate you guys. Thank you, gentlemen. We're putting that tone out, kind of helps to combat that.
Right. Right. It's not like going to the dentist, right? So, next slide, please. So I think this is our last slide, but it kind of breaks down our landings for you so you can see. So spotted sea trout is our big player. Red drum's down here at 14%. But we spend so much time in the state of Louisiana talking about red snapper, and I want you to realize it's only 3% of our total landings, right? But we spend an awful lot of time on it because of how it's handled federally. Sheepheader, about 4%. And then, you know, interesting is that we get this many white trout, right? I mean, 13% makes up a pretty good portion of the pie, I guess, so to speak. And, you know, up until 2 years ago, we started seeing more largemouth bass at saltwater creel assignments. They just were showing up because we were in kind of a fresh period, you know. Now we've had two drought years, back to back the past 2 years, and salinity's gotten higher. So there's a little bit less in our landings than we had recently, but they're still out there as well. And the croakers seem to be making a comeback. There's some larger croakers I've seen some catches this year, too.
The larger croakers
come back? I don't know. Maybe it's coincidental where there's less shrimp boats out there. I don't know.
Oh, I have a comment about that. So our shrimp industry, y'all shrimp industry is managed pretty well because you have gear restrictions and there's a difference between nearshore and offshore shrimp fisheries. So in the lovely state of North Carolina, there was a guy called Carlos Rafael, who I'm sure Chris and Jason probably read some articles about, but his nickname was the Cod Father. And he owned pretty much every boat in New Bedford, did all the stuff off like George's Banks, those legendary areas for what they would call brown fish, which are bottom fish. They do a lot of trawling. And basically, if the Cod Father's boat caught it, they found a way to make it disappear. It was just, you know, the fish houses. He owned, like, absolutely everything. Well, they caught him, and he went to jail for a little while. But don't feel bad for him, because he still has his permits. He makes probably, like, $20 million a year. He's going to land real softly from his prison sentence. But a few of those boats were sold to North Carolina because they have no regulations on inshore shrimp trawling. So when I looked at the redfish stock assessment, there were a couple of 100,000 adult redfish that were bycatch in the offshore shrimp industry, which is an issue. Okay, that's an issue. There's not a lot of observer coverage. But when you look at what's going on in North Carolina, so y'all, I was really happy to hear, like, hey, what's going on with the big croakers? Because in the bay, our bay, we had giant, like we call them horse croakers, and they would get like 17 to 21 inches. And they were awesome to catch. They'd pull your elbow out of the socket, like so much stronger than a striper.
Yep.
They were awesome. And then the shrimp fishery opened up in North Carolina, the bycatch was 2 billion croaker in 2020. And then the next after croaker is juvenile weak fish and juvenile spot. And they do it by pounds. So it takes like 7 juvenile weed fish to equal 1 pound, and we don't have any Kroger spot for weed fish. Because they bought the Carlos Rafael boats, and I can go real deep into it, but they're doing like 300-foot otter trawls inside Pamlico Sound and intercepting all those juvenile fish. So
to what Chris said about maybe the shrimp bins, there's a little bit less effort in the shrimp fishery, and maybe that's why you're seeing Kroger. That is a big bycatch issue with shrimp trawls, whatever trawls they use, we saw it trawls.
Where you come from, you even have a commercial spot industry, right? Where spot are fairly large. We don't have that down here.
Yeah, so everyone live lines spot. That's what you live line for giant stripers. And the spot pens will have 1,200 spot in it. Mm-hmm. And they'll just, as soon as it's not lively, they throw it back in, put a fresh spot on, mm-hmm. huge bait wells on the charter boats, and we don't have any spot anymore either. So. Yep. Just wanted to throw that bug up in there right before lunch. So it really go eat, go eat our own stuff. On a good note. Yeah.
And that is the end, so. Yep.
These percentages, mm-hmm. are there any particular ones that stand out that have changed, say, over the last decade? Just anecdotally, the area where I do most of my fishing, seems like the black drum were very plentiful, mm-hmm. years ago, and then they almost disappeared. I was rarely catching them. Now they seem to be making a little bit of a comeback, so I'm wondering if anybody else has experienced the same thing, and is anything specific about the black drum or other species where you've seen dramatic changes in those particular species, mm-hmm. and everything involved.
So that's a good segue, because coming up in our near commission meetings in the future here, probably January, I think, Jason's going to be presenting, February, he's going to be presenting a stock assessment on black drum, sheep's head, striped mullet, and then a flounder update. So flounder is a key one to keep a track of here, because we just put management action in 2 years ago with a closed season. So it'll be neat to see if we can kind of see any trend with that. I don't think it's enough time, 2 years, to see something significant, but it might be good. But also the black drum assessment will be coming back from all peer reviews that are going on, and it'll be interesting to see what that has. So keep tuned to future commission meetings, and we'll have that posted. Yes?
So I'll be talking a lot about the detail in a second about this, but I can't praise you all enough about how lovely it is to work with a battle like this. Mm-hmm. As an economist, that's just super rare. But the survey attrition you're talking about is alarming, and that rejection rate. Do you have any, I know from the state level, right, nobody, but maybe folks who are committed to helping, what would be the perception if you could sort of raffle off, like, incentivize a survey, right? So like every 1,000th survey or 100th survey gets a raffle winning. Would that breed more distrust, or would that help? Because it was also like a multi-year thing. As more and more right. people trust, then you tip the scales and you get good juju movement along, right?
Yeah.
But if it gets out of hand, then it renders the survey effort really difficult. And I understand the predictor that y'all are in. I love your point about noise, right? As the mm-hmm. survey goes down, the noise goes up, and
right.
it's really hard to measure if that standard error is going to blow up. So, like, is there things that people can do to, like, help y'all incentivize these surveys, or is it just going to breed more distrust?
We did some research on what would it take to get, we worked with somebody who did research on what would it take to get 100% compliance on tag returns,
right.
I think, for Red Snapper, and it was a $500 reward for tag. So I'm not there yet.
Right.
So I do as good as I can with the association, and I give you $500 to return that.
And so. One thing to notice on this, that the top of that scale is 4%. So it's not, yeah. it's not 100%.
Right.
But it is a trend we want to watch out for. It's not detrimental yet, and it is very localized. Now, part of that stems from, we've had longer and longer red snapper seasons over the past few years. 100% of those offshore charter captains get called weekly when snapper season is open. So that also leads to, like, you're calling me this week again. When typically, in the typical survey, if we selected you 1 week, you're not selected the next week, which could be the week after. When snapper season's open, if you're a captain that's possessing any of those offshore species, you're getting called every week. That doesn't help.
So it's important to be survey fatigue.
Oh, yeah. I think there's a lot of survey fatigue mm-hmm. in here. And then there's also another element that's part of this that's localized. But yeah, survey fatigue has a lot to do with this.
Is the response to that, or one of the solutions to that, more people participating less frequently? So sense of certain people carrying the brunt of the load? Is it like there's a million people that just do it every once in a while instead of 10,000 that have to do it every week? Is it something like that, or is that?
Well, so with those offshore charter captains, that frame is about 110 to 20 captains. If we didn't have to monitor Red Snapper weekly, but we do. So unfortunately, there's no good solution right now. And honestly, LaCreole, if it weren't for Red Snapper, we probably would need to go to a weekly level of resolution.
I think the next up there would just.
So the food is ready, and y'all are more than welcome to ask the folks from LBW questions while you're eating. So we have shrimp and grits, we have chicken, there's bread pudding with banana balls. Like, there's a lot of food here, so y'all, I hope y'all are hungry.
Schedule-wise,
here comes the schedule.
Like everyone, we don't want this to feel like you're in class and you're like, shit, man, I'm running out of brain space. Like, go take deep breath, chat with each other, make new connections and stuff, grab food, move some chairs around, get comfortable, and probably come back to both our last two speakers here, both dynamic, both have some energy, and also very easy going. So we might even be able to kick off the next one while everyone's kind of wrapping up lunch and try to keep everyone on schedule.
Give the next two not to be missed, so we have, like, the full-blown technology of how we're helping folks like Chris and Jason with, obviously, you got the impression of how important data is for them, and then it'll obviously be that kind of the economics of fishing, and Ben does this all the time with college students and grad students, so he should be able to handle y'all okay. But I know there's going to be a post-lunch, I want to take a nap, but let's just keep it going a little bit more. These will be two quick and awesome discussions, and then we'll wrap up. And we'll also draw like another raffle prize. So somebody, we got a bunch of stuff to give away. So
thank you, y'all.
Thank you.